Well, first off, you guys, we're going to present this topic, and if at any point you have a question, we can just stop right there and deal with it so you don't have to remember it till the end. I kind of like to keep a little bit of dialogue going to the extent possible. And we'll also have some room for questions at the end if anything comes up. I'm Brent Howell. I'm an entertainment attorney. I do IP work and technology work as well. I work for a law firm in Mississippi called Frescona Courtney. Represent independent artists, some smaller record labels, and done some litigation between record labels and distribution. So I'm kind of in this culture to a certain extent. And
My name's Ed Johnson. I'm a music industry consultant and worked with band management, dealing with both signed and unsigned bands. Probably the biggest artist that I've worked with is a metal band called Suffocation, signed to Nuclear Blast Records. And prior to that, I wrote a regular column for a music industry magazine called The Inside Connection. So I've dealt a lot with independent musicians and worked through the whole period of time with the internet. So, done a lot with that.
Okay. Now, just some general initial issues that I see a lot with new artists who are trying to get involved in the business, and I'm going to try to cover a little more than just the internet. But one thing to remember is the internet is huge. You really have to find your niche, really try to narrow down your market. Don't try to, for instance, if you are a metal band, don't try to promote to rock people, try to promote to metal people, and if you can, try to get even more specific than that. Because you've got as an artist, you've got a limited amount of time, limited amount of resources, and you don't want to spend them just going everywhere. Try to be focused with what you're doing. Music done right is a business. It's not a hobby. If you're going to really get into this, you're going to have to put some money down. It's a business expense. It's part of it, and you're going to have to work really hard. It's not something you can play around with, because if you do, it may be fun, but you're not really going to get anywhere. Ed, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, basically, if that's your purpose, actually, when I was introduced, I wanted to actually ask how many people in here are actually musicians in a band, songwriters, or anything of that nature? Okay, so most of you. Okay. As opposed to people who are just interested in music on the internet. What he's saying is basically, if you're looking to make music your profession, there are a lot of people who do it as a hobby, who just play local clubs, play the colleges, and that's like they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're whatever, and they play in a cover band on the weekend. But what we're talking about is we're assuming that you're interested in actually making music your profession and actually being in a hit band or writing for being a songwriter or composer or something like that. And you have to treat your art as a business, which for me, dealing with independent bands is actually the biggest hurdle I have to come over, is when you're giving someone who's a producer and he's in a studio and trying to tell a band to do this, that, and the other thing, and the bands are so worried about selling out and all the things that rock musicians are scared of, and like the moment you want someone to buy your music or pay to see you at a club, it's a business. And you treat it in many of the same ways that you treat a business. Of course, still enjoy it as your art and still try to create the best music that you can, but technically you've already sold out the moment you're trying to sell your music. So forget about worrying about that and just try to make the best music you can to make the best business decisions that you can.
Absolutely. Okay, well, again, presuming that we're going for the business approach, what's your purpose in trying to get your music and trying to go forward? First thing is you really want to get your music out to the public, because, of course, you're trying to sell it, and you can't do that if it's sitting in your garage. Also, you really want to create a buzz, because people need to know who you are. They're not going to know where to find you and that you're out there. You also want to build a solid brand. If you're a solo artist, your name is your brand. If you are part of a band, that name is your brand. And that's really what you're trying to, you want to create a quality product and associate that with that brand, so when people look at it and say, oh, I know what I'm getting.
That's actually something I wanted to comment on. Since this is about music for the internet, one of the things bands now have to start doing is when you're making up your artist name or your band name, thinking about domain names, because there have been bands out there that put wacky characters or unusual spellings that when you start making www.bandname.com, it becomes a problem because either the band name is too generic and it's very hard to find it. And, you know, like there's a band called Lard, and it's like, what if you're looking for, you know, the band Lard or the, so now you have all these websites that are so-and-so the band. .com. So thinking about domain names when you're coming up with the band name, thinking about if you have like rappers that put all these weird characters that you're not allowed to use in domain names. And making your domain name easy to remember or recognize. There's a band called Bile from New York, where I'm from, and their second album was called Techno Whore, and they called their website technowhore.com, which I'm sure gets them a lot of traffic for people who just see a t-shirt and be like, what the hell is that? So coming up with interesting and creative band names that lend themselves well to domain names is a step in music for the internet, and actually thinking of yourselves as internet bands.
Well, and another thing too, and this may be later on in the slides as well, but you also want to pick a name that's unusual in that if you go out on concert and or you're out somewhere and you're saying, you know, hi, my name is X, this is my band name, if someone tries to get online and Google your name, there may come up, you know, if there are multiple bands with the same name, they're going to find somebody else, and you don't want that. You want them to be able to find you if they want to look for you. And then the other goal being, of course, to make money, again, if this is a professional venture. And this is an example, like I was telling Ed a few minutes ago, my wife does a lot of graphic design and web work for some of my clients and some of hers. And this is an example of one artist that she worked with. And, you know, in this case, he was trying to create a brand name. His name was Jeff Maddox. So she created him a logo so that to use on his albums or anywhere online so that anytime someone saw that, they associate it with him. There are probably other guys named Jeff Maddox out there, but at least this way he can present something standard so people will know to look.
Well, part of creating a brand is keeping things consistent.
Absolutely.
It is perfectly reasonable for bands to have business cards, to have when you have your posters, your flyers. So if you hire a graphic designer or one of the band members is a graphic designer and creating a unique logo, make sure you use and use and use and use that logo for everything you're putting the band's name on. Your MySpace page, your t-shirts, your flyers, your business cards. So it's constantly repetition, typical advertising techniques of repetition, repetition, repetition. So, and that's all part of building the buzz and building the brand. So people start to identify you by that logo.
Yeah, and as an example, kind of jumping out of the music world for a second, you know, if you go down the street and you see a BP logo, good thoughts or bad thoughts, right now bad thoughts, you know who that company is associated with, that brick and mortar structure, you know that's them. And it's the same idea. You want, anytime someone sees that logo, you want to know that's you. And you also want to, you don't want to tarnish that name either, whatever that means in your particular niche. You know, you want people to have good thoughts about it. Now, start off with, you know, before we even get to the internet, you have to have something to sell. You have to have your music to get out there. So first thing is you really need to create a professional album to the extent you can. Now, I know there are a lot of, because of technology, there are a lot of places that you can go. You can buy equipment and just kind of record it yourself. You're not going to have the same kind of polished sound quality that you're going to get from a professional studio. Now, professional studio is also going to cost money. So there's kind of a balancing act there. There are plenty of reputable studios that are not in Nashville or in L.A. One thing I hear from a lot of my clients is, you know, especially from my country music clients, they feel like, oh, well, I need to go record in Nashville because I'll get discovered there. That's not the purpose.
Let me call you back.
You want to get studio that will be able to put a good product out for you, but don't worry so much about the glitz and glamour associated with a particular studio.
Probably the biggest mistake an independent artist will make is recording their music too soon. I actually just had this conversation just a couple of days ago. An artist had a MySpace page and says, what do you think of my music? And it was awful. And I was just like, how long has the band been together? They're like, you know, 3 weeks. And it's like, and you're already putting your music out there for people to evaluate and judge. It's like, do you rehearse? I mean, we're talking about 16-year-old kids who have just gotten together and thanks to the internet have the ability to put their music out there, which is great. That's the best thing about the internet, and it's also the worst thing about the internet is bands that are just not ready are putting their music out there, and they're not going through the same, you know, rehearsal process that you used to have to, because when you know you got to plop down $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 to record a CD, you're not just going to do it on a whim. But if you can just record on GarageBand and be able to have an MP3 with the investment of $100, then people are going to do that. And maybe occasionally you'll get lucky and just get someone who's just so freaking talented that it's going to be good, but most of the time it's just going to be awful. And once I've already heard your music, even if a year later, like, hey, we played you our music and now we have it better, I'm going to be like, oh, you were that crappy band from a year ago. It's like, I've already got it in my head that you suck. So it is, again, cliched as it sounds, your first impression is that don't put your music out there until you're ready.
Absolutely. And again, because of the internet, once something gets on the internet, it never comes off. So, you know, if 2 years, 3 years down the line, you're doing good stuff now, people are looking for you, they start seeing the old stuff that you've grown beyond. So you want to be real careful with that. The other thing, too, is that whenever you go to a studio, especially if you're going on a budget, you want to go in there, you want to be rehearsed, you want to be ready to go. Have all your music written, have everything laid out, because studios charge by the hour. So the quicker you can be in, the quicker you can be out, the more effective you're going to be from a price standpoint. Another issue is, do you need a producer? Do you need a sound engineer? Typically, at a very minimum, you're going to need a sound engineer at the studio. You need somebody who knows what they're doing, with whether they're using Pro Tools or some other industry standard software. You need somebody who knows how to work it, somebody who knows what it's going to take to make your music sound its best. And you're really not going to get that if you're just playing around in there. Also, producer is probably a good idea. Producer is going to be able to help you organize your album in the best way possible. Maybe give you some ideas. Okay, this track is a little weaker. Maybe we need to put something else in there in its place.
In my experience, truly independent artists rarely get a producer. Quality producers are hard to come by.
True.
Most of them charge an upfront fee. A lot of them will also charge, if there's a potential you could be a signed artist, will ask for points on your album, which essentially means they get a percentage. And sometimes recording studios will do what's called a spec deal, which sometimes it's awesome and sometimes they're ripping you off, where basically they say, we'll let you use our facilities and record your album for free or for a substantially reduced rate in exchange for percentages on your album, which could be a good thing. But let's say, you know, Aerosmith, and all of a sudden your CD sells very well, you're giving over tens of thousands of dollars to someone who did $3,000 worth of work. For the most part, again, in my experience, the independent artists generally do not get producers unless they have a friend who happens to just know music very well. But it's really not something that your first album you're going to have to worry about.
Okay. And yeah, just something to think about as you move forward again. Other thing is, it's best to get some professional graphic artwork. Yeah, a lot of people have a copy of Photoshop, and you can get your cousin to knock something out there for you. But especially if you're going to be putting stuff out online, you really want to have good imagery with it, because that's what people are seeing. You know, they're not seeing your face, they're seeing this picture. So, and a graphic artwork may not be that expensive. It's just a matter of doing it.
There are a lot of graphic artists you could find on Craigslist, on DeviantArt, but we're going to address this a little bit later on, but for right now, I'll just say the main reason you want professional graphic artwork is not just to make the CD look good, is at some point you're going to want to think about t-shirts, and we'll address that later.
And this is just an example, again, like I said earlier, my wife does a lot of this kind of stuff. This was one of our kind of, I guess you'd say, co-clients. And this is kind of showing that you can do a lot of things without just slapping a picture on there. For instance, there's some using different imagery and different textures. You don't have to just put your picture on the front. And that's what I've noticed a lot of novice bands want to do, take a snapshot of myself sitting somewhere, slap it on the front of the logo, or on the front of the album. And you can probably come out better with that if you take some thought and get somebody who knows what they're doing to help you out. another initial issue before you even get to the internet stage is you need to at least have an idea of what kind of legal protections you can have going forward so you don't have people running off and ripping off your stuff. One thing is trademark protection. You've got a band name, you've got your logo, you're going to put either money or time or both behind promoting this brand image. It doesn't hurt to consider trademark protection. Now, you get some automatic rights in some states, but this actually helps if someone else is trying to use your band name. You know, after you put some time into it, you can tell them stop. Other thing is copyrights. You can file copyrights on your music. Usually, I recommend filing a Form SR, sound recording copyright, on the album itself, and a Form PA on the actual songwriting. So there are some things you can do, again, to protect yourself in the event that you have people later just taking your music and just copying it and selling it.
Well, conversely, when you are creating your band name, make sure no one else has it.
Also true.
Do the research on bandname.com, and there's a bunch of different online resources, but I more than once see a band start to generate some local buzz, start to thinking about should we send our stuff out to labels, and then at that point find out that another artist already owns that name and not being able to pursue it. So basically they have to, even though their music stays the same, they have to change the name of the band and essentially start back from scratch. So when you're just starting out, if you have a band name, make sure that not only that you trademark, make sure no one else has.
Right, and once you trademark, you're locked in with the trademark office. Nobody else can come back in and trademark it over you, and you have some legal grounds to tell somebody else, look, this is my band name, stop. Yes, sir?
When you talk about a new brand, that guy just asked, that's his name, so technically you could copyright or trademark that. Is he actually trademarking the font that you use to make up his name and the look of it, or how's that work?
You always have a certain amount of trademark protection in your name, but someone else, conversely, has the same rights. So another Jeff Maddox can still use his name. But, yes, you can trademark your the logo, you can trademark the font, all of the imagery that's associated with that name. And it helps a lot, really, even when you're not using your name, to put a logo when you're trademarking just for various legal reasons. It's easier to get a trademark when you're doing that. So having a strong logo helps a lot from a trademark standpoint. Yes, ma'am.
How much do you see
that? For instance, if you were going to trademark it yourself, the trademark office charges $275 for their filing fee. If you wanted to get me to do it, I would charge a search fee and a filing fee, which usually ends up running about $1,800. That's because I'm doing a lot of the legwork, and that's also for, you know, the fact that I've been doing this for years. I know where you're going to run into problems. But that's kind of the realm you're looking at, and that's going to depend. If you're going to hire an attorney, obviously it's going to cost more. If you're going to hire an attorney in a major metropolitan area, it's probably going to cost more. For instance, I'm in Mississippi. My overhead's a lot lower than somebody in Atlanta or even in D.C., so your prices are going to vary up or down depending on who you're dealing with. But that's kind of what you're looking at.
The good news is you only have to do it once.
Absolutely.
Unless you keep changing the name of the artist.
Right, right. Okay, and then now to the fun stuff, getting your product actually out there. There's several different ways you can go about doing online distribution, and there are a lot of companies that do it. These are some of the companies that I've dealt with personally on varying levels. You know, your big daddy's iTunes. Most people buy their music from iTunes. You want to be on iTunes. Problem is, you can't just go to iTunes and say, here, put my music up. They deal on the major record level. And, you know, if you're not Paul McCartney, they will not talk to you. So you're going to have some kind of an intermediary. And who knows, they might not even talk to him personally. They probably do. But you need some kind of intermediary to get you from where you are to them. Taking that step down, you've got Iris is another company that I've dealt with. They work well, but they deal with record labels. Again, you're not going to be able to go directly to them unless you've got a large catalog of stuff, which as an independent artist, usually you won't unless you've been at this for a long time. CD Baby is really the level that an independent artist is going to be at, and I'm a huge fan of them. They're a great deal for a small artist. Last time I checked, it cost $35 to put an album up on CD Baby.
$40.
Is it $40 now?
Yeah.
Okay. And they will take your music, they will put it out on several different internet retail sites like iTunes, Napster, Rhapsody, all those. And they also have a physical distribution element if that's somewhere you want to go. If you actually decide to go and manufacture a CD and go that route, they can do
that. That's actually how they started. CD Baby is actually, because I've worked with them myself. I actually many years ago did a panel similar to this, and Derek Sivers, the founder of CD Baby, was one of the panelists. And basically, he created it because at this point, this is now like the mid to late 90s, there really was no avenues for independent artists to distribute their music, especially online. At that point, online sales were still very, very new. What we were talking about before is the reason why prior to the internet you wanted to get signed to a record label is they could do things that you could not do yourself, primarily distribution, getting your music into stores, and exposure, getting your music onto the radio, MTV, tour support, etc. The internet solved one of those problems, and CD Baby was one of those where someone will actually sell your music online for a nominal fee and for a small percentage of the sales, so you can actually make money selling your music, and they also help selling other products like your t-shirts and stuff like that. Then later, they added online digital distribution by being what's called an iTunes aggregator. And there's a bunch of different companies that do this, but they all work on the same process. You pay them a small fee and a percentage, and they'll get your music listed on iTunes. But notice I said listed. Everybody's listed on iTunes. iTunes is the number one music retailer and controls over 70% of worldwide digital music sales. So 70% of anything sold online musically is through iTunes. This was our solution to the record labels controlling everything. So now instead of four companies controlling everything, there's now one company controlling everything thanks to the decentralization of the internet. Thank you, Steve Jobs. But regardless, what CD Baby allows you to do is choose whether you want to sell physical CDs or digital music or both. And they'll take a small percentage, and they are the largest online community for independent artists with over 278,000 artists listed on their service. So if you were looking for new independent music and you actually want to buy a CD, CD Baby is the way to go. They also have services where it's like, I like Metallica, who's similar to Metallica or Depeche Mode or whatever.
I was going to ask, what are the advantages of physical CDs these days? Because I just take a CD, rip it into iTunes, and then put the CD away and never look at it again.
The advantage of a physical CD is if you're an independent artist, the majority of new fans you're getting are ones that come and see you live at a club or a concert. And you could tell them, go to our website, www.bandname.com, and buy our music. Or you could sell it to them right there at the show. And you could do it through a physical CD, or you can do it what's called a drop card, which is basically a little card with a piece of digital code where they can download the song later if they don't want a CD. The other advantage of it is there are people who, just like people who still collect records, still like to have a physical CD in hand. They still like to open it up and read liner notes and actually be able to see the graphics. So you'll get those people as well. Increasingly, it's going to get rarer and rarer, and yeah, I do believe that at some point it's pretty much going to be all digital, except for a few technophobes who are still collecting physical copies. But the main advantage for an independent artist is to be able to sell your music right at your shows and be able to get money for it.
And kind of dovetailing on that too, it depends partially on who your audience is. Physical distribution is not going to be nearly as much if you're putting out music and targeting teenagers, because they're going to download music. But if your target demographic is 60 plus, they are not going to download it. They're going to want a physical album to keep with them, and because there's that technophobe aspect. Now, as we go along, obviously a lot of those older people are not going to be purchasing music anymore, and that will be less and less of an issue, but that's something to consider. All right. And it's not just enough to put your music out online. You have to actually drive people to it. So the first thing you got to do is actually promote your music once it's out there. I really feel like traditional concerts are a must. You need to be touring. You need to be out there trying to drum up support. And you know, you need to sell your merchandise while you're there. Again, like we were discussing earlier, you know, that's where you're going to make most of your money as an independent artist, is at those shows, set up a table. You've got your t-shirts. If you've got other little gigaws that really identify with your band, have those out there. You need somebody working that booth whenever you're up singing, or conversely, you know, before and after the show, because you want to make that sale right then. Impulse purchase is huge.
Merchandising is pretty much the most important thing you're going to be doing early on as an independent artist as far as revenue. This is my area of expertise. This is what I was doing for Suffocation. I was getting their t-shirts into Hot Topic and looking at alternative revenue streams. The great thing about t-shirts is your markup for t-shirts is phenomenally better than the markup for your CDs. Essentially, your CDs are going to be a loss leader. A lot of times CDs are given away for free. You give out CDs. Another advantage of CDs is some media outlets like reviewers still like to receive CDs for review. Otherwise, you're just emailing them a MySpace or a download link. But your t-shirts are, you get them screen printed, first and foremost. Do not use Cafe Press. It's a great service, there's nothing wrong with them, but you're losing too much of your revenue possibilities to the Cafe Press process. Just pony up the money up front, because you'll be able to get them printed for $3 to $5 a unit, and a good t-shirt could easily sell for $15. If you have a nice design, this is going back to, you want t-shirts that people who aren't even your fans will want to buy just because the artwork is awesome or you have a cool logo or slogan. Most screen printers, if you're doing a gross, you're doing 144 t-shirts, almost every screen printer I know is you can get $3 to $5. It's when you're doing it by the dozen that you got to pay $6 to $8. But if you know, you're coming up with a band logo, you only want to have maybe at most 2 to 3 different designs of your t-shirts. Because again, you're talking about earlier in your career, you probably only have one album or two albums out. So you have like a band t-shirt and then maybe an album t-shirt. And then if you have one particular big hit song, make that as a third design. And you have some cool artwork or a funny slogan or something relevant to your fan base, if they're science fiction fans or if they're horror fans or if they're like whatever would appeal to that market. But I've bought t-shirts of bands I've never heard of just because the shirt was amazing. Again, the Bile issue I brought up before, their shirts look amazing because they get the cool artists to do it, and their fans are sick heavy metal industrial fans. So it's like, I don't even care who this band is. I have people have, oh, you like Crass? No, you're wearing their shirt. And so you're going to make more money selling your t-shirts that way, by just getting the band together and investing the money and getting the t-shirts printed. I mean, Seattle Shirts in Seattle, they do the shirts pretty cheap. But I mean, just look online, band t-shirts, screen printing. Don't use Cafe Press. Don't use Zazzle. Don't use any of those things, because you don't want to sell them one at a time. And also, you can bring them to the shows and, again, sell them at your shows. But besides t-shirts, stickerguy.com. 250 stickers, $20, include shipping. I don't work for them. I'm not making any money. They're just a great service. I've used them. Buttons. There's a lot of good button companies online. But get creative, depending on who your market is, depending on who your fans are. I've seen custom printed temporary tattoos, and I can't believe bands aren't going apeshit over this. Because if you have a large female following, you got a lot of good-looking women who are your fans, you give out temporary tattoos of your band logo and send them out to the beach. It's like how people, you can get screen printed condoms, you can get screen printed frisbees, and you know, again, depending on who your market is, but get creative. I saw a band that had their band t-shirts had support local music, sleep with a band. The fact that teenage girls were wearing this was a little disturbing, but at least they thought of something clever that promoted the band, include the band website on the t-shirts, of course. But do more than just t-shirts and stickers. You go to a screen printer and you say, what are your full list of merchandise? And they literally 10, 20,000 products, mugs, water bottles, candy bars, full water bottles with water in them, soda cans with soda in them. You can sell. I had a band at the Philadelphia Music Conference hand me a candy bar with the band logo and information on it. This is about 15 years ago. If that band called me tomorrow, I'd remember who they were. So it's like, just be creative with it, and some of it's going to be for promotional use, but a lot of it could be to make money for the band.
Well, another thing to remember too, and this kind of dovetails into that, is do your homework when you're doing your merchandise. There are certain price points where it suddenly becomes much more economical to buy these things. You know, small lots are usually you're going to get raked over the coals. Bigger lots you're going to do okay. Like, as an example, I just happen to know that with when you're having CDs printed, 1,000 is the sweet spot. If you try to order in lots of 500, you're going to pay twice as much per unit as if you buy 1,000 a go.
Yeah, like 500 CDs, $850, 1,000 CDs, $1,000.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's really ridiculous, the slight difference in that much more in quantity. So, again, that's another reason for kind of standardizing your products to a certain extent, so you can buy one big lot rather than several small lots, because it really does make a difference. And the other thing with your traditional concerts, kind of moving back to that, is it really allows you to drive popularity with a known fan base. These are people that have actually gotten out of their comfort zone. You know, they're not sitting on the couch, they're here to listen to you. They've already expressed an interest. So these are a lot more likely to respond to things that you're doing than just the average person off the street. And get contact info from these people by any means necessary.
Mailing list. Get the girls with the mailing list forms.
Yeah, absolutely. Because these people, again, they've come out to see you. If you put on a good show, they're going to want to come back. You want to be able to get in contact with them next time you're in that location or next time you put an album out. You want to have a good, strong mailing list for e-blast and for whatever promotional purposes. Then that's huge.
As far as the fan base goes, how I defend a band's fan base is the people who come to see you who are not your friends. Your friends and your family will bail on you when you need them the most. Because more than once, I would put on a showcase for a band, and at one show, they would bring a lot of people, but I would see them interacting, and it's all their friends. And then I would book them for a showcase and actually bring a label rep from Atlantic or whoever to come take a look at this band, and those same friends had something better to do that night, and they just bailed them when the band needed them most. So the people who are your fan base are the people who are coming for your music, not because you begged them to. Just want to get that out there.
And your question.
I saw this one band with my daughter. They were giving away stuff that you give them your email address.
Absolutely.
Great idea. Yeah.
Sign our mailing list and get something. You can get a candy bar. You can get a free download of one of our songs. Reduced price off the next concert. But yeah, doing some sort of promotional tie-in or giveaway. And you can, it doesn't even have to be something out of pocket. You can partner. Well, you know, that's another big thing that I'm big on is partnerships and sponsorships. If your fan base is the exact same demographic of something that another, let's say, for example, your fan base are like heavy metal guys with a lot of tattoos, and find a tattoo shop and say, hey, give me a 15% coupon off a tattoo for anyone that signs our mailing list. It doesn't have to be stuff that has to be coming out of your pocket. Save money by partnering up with other people who want to attract the same fan base that you're going for. It's all about the demographics.
General owners had just come out with some new car that would go to the same market,
mm-hmm.
age group, and so they were giving away...
Cars?
No.
I'd sign that mailing list.
Oh, absolutely.
For a raffle to possibly win a car, and the GM people were there just heavily promoting it.
That's fine.
But to get the ticket, you have to give your email address.
Yeah, it's standard online marketing is in order to get whatever the goodie is and get access, you know, you sign up and you register. And, you know, just as long as you have a legitimate mailing list and give them the option to opt out if they don't want your spam and don't go crazy with it, I think any kind of gimmick that's, as long as it's legitimate and you keep it reasonable, I think one email every 2 weeks at most, unless you have an inordinate amount of shows. But just to let them know what's going on, new album out, and anything like that, I think that's perfectly reasonable. And definitely some sort of promotional tie-in with another group or agency or company, I think that's great.
actually going to the table where they're giving stuff away and showing up at the table for the personal lunch. People actually get to talk to them. One place I went, the band was actually selling the CDs during the break.
Yeah.
Well, that's the assumption is, again, we're talking about independent artists. We're assuming that they don't have a staff. So they're pretty much just going to be them, their friends, and their girlfriends slash boyfriends. So, yeah, of course the band members are going to be most likely working. The only time is going to be when they're actually performing. That's when they have, like, the friends, girlfriends, or whatever working the booth. But for the most part, the band members are going to be doing it mostly themselves. So, yeah, having that personal touch is like, I'm the singer, I'm the bassist, I'm the drummer, or whatever, and appearing. And then if a band starts getting more popular, then you could start doing things where a personal appearance is something special, you know, such as a signing, that's one of the things I used to arrange was, like, the band will be at this record store or head shop or whatever, and actually doing a signing and doing a giveaway or doing some sort of promotion. Someone over there had...
I've got a friend of mine firsthand who's got a band in Columbus, Georgia. They've reached out a lot to their first-hand customers and people who are into them in that local area.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll only go so far, and then they sold to these T-shirts, these CDs, and it's over. But they've recently reached out to other groups via Twitter, MySpace, Facebook, and actually booked a show with the Misfits in December, which I don't know if y'all know, but I'm a huge fan of Misfits. It's a band
I'm familiar with the Misfits.
This, you know, horror punk band, right? Right. Everybody should know.
I'm old school punk, yeah. I know the Misfits are.
So they booked a show with them, and I think it's important that people book.
Now, how did they book the show? Was it pay for play, or did they book it?
Yeah,
oh, they paid?
Right, they did pay.
All right.
Yeah. Not much, but I mean, really, they will make enough in merch and otherwise to pay for their gas and everything to get there. I mean, I've played in bands that have traveled to Pennsylvania and made $20 for
right.
six guys and made nothing. But I think it's important that people reach out to farther groups that will help them in the long
yes.
run.
Let me break that into two areas. We'll separate the Misfits and the pay for play as a separate discussion point. But your first point, I think, is absolutely correct. Ironically, thanks to the internet, a band in a smaller market has advantages over bands in New York, where I'm from. Because in New York, not only the fact that there's so many bands, but there's also so many other things to do. It's not just go see one band, band A or band B. It is go see band A, band all the way to band triple X, to go to the museum, go to clubs, go to anything that there is to do in New York. So in a large market like New York, you're actually suffering because you don't need to be in New York to attract record label attention. As far as getting outside of your immediate area, I absolutely agree with that. Find using MySpace, Twitter, Facebook, etc., find similar bands to trade gigs with. So if you play at a Friday night at your local club and you're guaranteed 100 people, and you find another band in another town where you can't draw anybody, but they play in front of 100 people, let them open for you so that you open for them. And this way you start partnering up with these other bands and benefit each other and starting to share crowds. I don't know if you...
And that's a great idea, and I think that's the main thing, especially initially, is to build up enough of a following locally where you can do that. So you start out, as you said, there's kind of a saturation point, but you want to push that saturation point as quick as you can so you can start branching beyond that.
As far as pay for play, there are benefits to it. I won't set an absolute don't never do it, because if you're saying they didn't pay that much and they got to play in front of the Misfits and they're going to do that, then okay, maybe it's going to work out for them. But I mean, I was working on trying to get Suffocation on some of the big, you know, Family Values tours and stuff like that, or Ozfest, and some of the numbers being thrown at you are just like, I'm talking like $80,000 for, you know, stage B. And we were just screw you. You know, it's like, I'm sorry. It's like we're going to get it on our own merits. But so pay for play is very, very tricky. There are companies out there, because here's the problem with pay for play. The moment you open that door, there's going to be companies that will start offering that service that may not be legitimate. Believe it or not, there are some people in the music industry who are not entirely honest. There's a lot of people independent contract publicists or agencies and whatnot, and a manager that asks for money up front sometimes is legitimate. There are legitimate reasons why a manager will want money up front. Most of the time, however, it is not legitimate. So when you open up pay-for-play opportunities, you are going to get all sorts of people who can promise that and may not be able to deliver to the extent that you're envisioning. That's why I have problems with pay-for-play.
And I would also suggest, if you're going to do pay-for-play, if you can get a reasonable fee on it, do it a couple of times and see if it works. You know, don't try to overextend yourself and book way out and do a lot of these until you see if it's going to happen.
Well, my thing is, if you're used to playing for 100 people in your local town, which is very small, mm-hmm. they all have your merchandise, they all have your CD, they know all your songs. If you have the opportunity to play in front of 2,000 people in front of a nationally known band, if it costs you $150, $200, it's totally worth it because you're getting your name out there.
But it's not going to cost $150. Most of the time, it's not going to cost that. If they got it for that price, then they really lucked out. The other downside is it opens up the opportunity for bands that are not, for lack of a better term, good enough to play. And then it soils the market for that sort of thing. When promoters are more concerned about, I can get some crap band to pay me X amount of dollars instead of working to try to find qualified opening acts to fill in these opening slots, again, it sets a pretty dangerous precedent where because a lot of times the headlining bands often have veto rights over, The Sisters of Mercy did that once about a week before a show. They said, we don't want these opening bands, and they had to get all new opening bands. So if you start doing pay-for-play, what happens if the Misfits, if an independent promoter set that up, if it wasn't directly set up through the Misfits, what happens if the Misfits say, we don't want this band to open for us, they're terrible? You know, it's like when bands start paying for opportunities instead of earning them through the quality of their music, it opens up to a lot of bad music getting exposure that it probably shouldn't have, which is another secret of the music industry. A lot of independent bands are not independent because they're not given their crack. A lot of independent bands are independent because they're just not very good. And for better or for worse, the previous music industry standard of record independent and major record labels acted as a filter that kept the amount of bands out there that you can kind of pay attention to within a reasonable grasp of how many CDs were being released. With the internet, you have literally access to every piece of music that's out there. So how do you pick? How do you find new music that's good besides your friends and blogs that you trust? But there's no tastemakers anymore. There's no A&R filtering process. And yeah, some of the bands they picked were terrible. You get the New Kids on the Block and whatever. So it wasn't perfect, but at least it acted as a filter instead of just 10,000 bands of noise out there that you can't find quality music unless you're just really, really lucky.
And the other issue with that is if you are a quality band, now you're fighting against this noise. And that's kind of where we're going now is, you know, you need to get those concert dates and try to get some concert dates out of your area. There are just as many local clubs on the other side of the country as there are this one, most likely. So, you know, one of the ways you can do that is build a good electronic press kit. That it's a very useful tool for trying to get dates. You want something that kind of displays what you are, what you're about, with some music. Sonic Bids is kind of the standard there. You can do an EPK, and then you can use that, go out, find whether it's promoters or whether it's go directly to the clubs. Here's my EPK. Take a listen. If you like it, I'll come play. And,
the downside, I mean, Sonic Bids is a great service. I have nothing bad to say about Sonic Bids. I do have something bad to say about some of the people that use Sonic Bids. Having an EPK, the $4 or $5 a month that you pay for Sonic Bids is totally worth it. What some people do to try to exploit Sonic Bids is they have what's called Dropbox opportunities, where a songwriting contest or a lot of big ones is like South by Southwest and people like that who have showcasing opportunities. And to submit your music to these Dropbox opportunities, you pay a small fee. It could be as little as $3, but some of the bigger songwriting contests, it's literally $20 per submission per song. So if you want them to hear more than one song, you have to submit multiple times. And some of them, like including South by Southwest, which has about 2,000 showcasing bands, a lot of them exclusively only use Sonic Bids, meaning you can't mail them your CD. You can only submit through Sonic Bids. And they're using it as a revenue generator. They're not using it as a way. It is a great way to find new music. I've found great music through Sonic Bids by just going through and listening to EPKs. I've opened Dropbox opportunities, and you have to charge. You're not allowed to open a Dropbox opportunity for free. So I would charge $3, which was the absolute minimum, and get good music. So use Sonic Bids. If you're not already on Sonic Bids, I wholeheartedly recommend them. However, there is a tendency to go a little crazy with the Dropbox. Oh, yeah, let's do that. Oh, yeah, let's do that. The main reason to get Sonic Bids is to have a good electronic press kit so that someone from anywhere can hear your music, see videos, read your lyrics, read your bio. It's everything about your band in one little digital snapshot.
Well, and you don't necessarily have to use the Sonic Bids infrastructure either. You can actually pick up the phone and call somebody and be like, hey, you know, I've got a band, I'd love to come play at your place, go look at my EPK on Sonic Bids. Then you can kind of funnel them there, and that might get you around some of those submission issues, especially if you're looking at smaller venues. And you can just kind of go by area, pick a region, okay, I want to move my tour in this direction, okay, where can I play here? Call around. Which, of course, that leads into a lot of hard work because, you know, you're going to have to filter down to the promoters and the venues that will actually are right for you, I guess is the best way to put it.
Well, the good thing about it is if you're not using the Dropbox opportunities and just going directly to the promoters and submitting your EPKs directly to them, you are saving on the expense of mailing a CD and press kit. So you figure you're probably saving for each press kit you're not sending out, you're saving $4 or $5 for mailing costs, physical production costs, and the cost of the CD and materials in there. So it does save money in the long run if you use it intelligently. And you can get, a lot of promoters will accept EPKs as a way to find out, like they don't need to get your CD mailed to them anymore. They'll be able to listen to your music and gauge if it's something that would work for their club or their whatever their thing is.
Another thing you can consider once you've kind of gotten to, once you've built your band up to the point where it's is appropriate, is you may want to consider a booking agent. Booking agent is going to be somebody who, they are a salesman. That is what they do. And a good booking agent is going to know the market. They're going to know, they're going to have a relationship with other venues, so they're going to be able to get you in that door where you may not be able to get yourself. However, again, when you start paying more people, you got to recoup those costs. So it's kind of when you're ready for that, that's something to consider.
The big advantage of a booking agent is if you're ready for a booking agent and they start becoming interested in you, they can also set you up with tours with other bands. They can set you up with those opening opportunities a little easier, just like a record label can. If you are on a good, like when Suffocation was signed to Nuclear Blast, it opened the door to being, okay, now we can start touring with other Nuclear Blast artists. And so a good booking agent, and again, you have to filter and you have to check the backgrounds, make sure it's not just some guy who's charging you to play gigs. A good booking agent is legitimate. They will have a stable roster of bands that you'll be able to check, and you will be able to see exactly how they, you know, the percentages. Because most of these, like a manager, booking agents work on a percentage.
Okay, and while we're on the subject, ReverbNation.com, I hear they have...
They're a good company.
They have... you can make some really good press kits using their service, so they may be an alternative to Sonic Bids. Does Reverb Nation actually host them as well?
Oh, yeah. They do. They actually have widgets that allow you to, like, when you make changes, they'll allow fans to actually host your information and music on them. I've known Reverb Nation since they... I knew the founder, Lou Playa, one of the co-founders. Fantastic website, and it's, I don't know what they charge, but I know it's very cost-effective, very user-friendly.
So they're another one to consider if Sonic Bids is not for you for whatever reason. All right, now to the general social network marketing stuff.
I hate Facebook. So I hate it.
First off, Facebook, which heavily used. It's got their upsides and downsides. I have a client who has very successfully managed to use Facebook to keep himself busy. I think he was doing, I want to say like 100 shows a year. I mean, he was moving just because he used that as a utility to reach out to his fans and keep in touch with his fan base. Now, the downside being that you can end up with, you can kind of get lost on it because there's so much stuff on there. One thing you can do with Facebook is you can find bands that are on there that are similar to your genre, and you can target their fans. Okay, this is somebody who apparently likes music like what I do, so contact them. Hey, you want to be my friend? Then you can try to get in touch with them. What's your feeling on Facebook?
Basically, here's the thing with Facebook and MySpace. I'm going to lump these two together. You have to be on them. You don't have a choice. They're free. There's no reason not to. Just don't expect too much. Because, especially with MySpace, MySpace has essentially been killed because of bands. Bands killed MySpace because it is all producers, no consumers. Everyone on MySpace is promoting something. No one is going on MySpace going, I want to find new music. For every one of those people, there is 10,000 people promoting their company or their band or their whatever, and it's like every comment on your page is just going to be some other schmuck promoting their thing. It is just that noise again. It is that equal opportunity to promote your own crap. And YouTube, I think, out of those three, YouTube is much better. And I see at the bottom of the list, I had a whole thing on Jonathan Coulton, so I'm glad he has that. I think have your Facebook and do all the Facebook things. You might sell a CD or two. Awesome. Do the MySpace thing. You have to. It's free. You got to do it.
Right.
You must. Well, I'm sorry?
If MySpace is completely noise and all noise, no signal, why bother with it?
Because it's still free. And free is still a band's best friend. And if you get anything out of it, even if you connect with another band, that's where I think the MySpace is a way to find new fans. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. I doubt it. As a way to, as he was just saying, connecting with other bands that you could trade gigs with and do other things with, that I think it has a greater functioning for. I think that it's just don't get sucked into the whole MySpace nonsense and think that, you know, like, oh, plug my music. Really, if you're going to really use MySpace seriously, then actually go and listen to other bands and really comment on them and not just use the comments as a plug for yourself. And find if there are like groups or organizations that are on MySpace where their membership or their focus is similar to your band's target demographic, then again, legitimately participate and comment. Just like if it was a forum or a news group, by dating myself with news group, or anything like that, honestly participate before you start pitching your own thing. Then you might get some benefit out of MySpace. The reason why I like YouTube is because YouTube has consumers going to YouTube. People go to YouTube to watch videos. It's not just on MySpace where you just go to promote your own thing. People go to YouTube because they want to see something funny or clever or interesting or maybe informative. So if you have a good YouTube channel for your music and you've got interesting music videos or interviews or just funny stuff that the band's doing on their day off, then you have a potential of actually getting people to view it. And I'll let him go into Jonathan Coulton.
Well, before we quite get there, one thing you can do with MySpace, one of the benefits of it is they have a very good utility for actually playing your music. You can't do that on Facebook. So if nothing else, MySpace is worth doing just to have an area where you can, for free, with a music player on it, you can set up your site and you can funnel people to MySpace. Here, go to my MySpace page and listen. Don't necessarily use their networking, but use their software. Yeah.
Reverb Nation actually has a widget called My Band that you can play on Facebook now for free.
Okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a nice little blend.
Thank you.
Cool. So, yeah, you can do that with Reverb Nation as well, and use both. That's part of the deal with the internet is most of it is free, and you can do a lot of cross-linking and cross-marketing and move people around to all of your content. So if they don't catch you on Reverb Nation, they catch you on MySpace.
Right.
Try to cast as wide of a net as you can.
There's no reason not to use free resources. You know, Craigslist is free. They have a music section. You're probably not going to get much traction from it, but there's no reason not to use it because anything that it does for you is a benefit, is a no-cost benefit.
Right.
Right.
Yes, sir.
What you're basically saying is if you don't use it, you know they won't see it.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you do use it,
they might.
Again, the worst advertising, yes, it is a free marketing element that is not very effective, but it is more effective than nothing. And unless you're a jackass, there's no negative consequence. If you annoy people through MySpace, then there could be a negative backlash, like, oh my God, this band is annoying the hell out of me, so just don't be that guy. You know, it's like, you know, just like you're walking around, don't be a jerk, and you won't get the negative connotations of being a jerk. So if you use MySpace, Facebook, etc., effectively and properly, maybe something can happen, but you use it as networking more than as a way to generate fans.
Okay. Well, and moving on to the rights control issue, and this is something I see a lot that musicians are concerned about protecting their music. They don't want anybody ripping their music off, whereas the public is usually more concerned about downloading music. So that's kind of the question is, do you want to control your rights or do you want to kind of give people free rein to reuse your stuff? And honestly, I'm kind of the opinion, especially with small bands, that really anonymity is your biggest enemy, not people stealing your stuff. In fact, if someone will take your music for free and show it to someone else, that's advertising. That's not a bad thing. And one of the things that comes up kind of in this area is Creative Commons. I know you wanted to say something about that specifically.
Well, I mean, I think maybe if you could just explain the actual technical definition of Creative Commons.
Okay, well, basically, Creative Commons is a kind of a project to give standardized licensing that's usable by basically non-lawyers. You don't need to hire me to write a Creative Commons license. You can actually use theirs and use that license as a way of giving other people rights to reuse your stuff. So if somebody wants to take your music, put it with some video and make a cool music video and put it out there, you can give them permission to do that using a Creative Commons license, and they know they're not going to get sued and you still get your advertising.
Because the alternative is if you put out your music under a normal traditional license, anybody that wants to use your music for anything, even non-commercial purposes, you have to give permission to on a case-by-case basis. And this is not just for independent artists. Both Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails have used the Creative Commons license. Radiohead released a whole album under it, and Nine Inch Nails released a couple albums under it, and Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails put out their music for a remix contest. And he actually allowed and encouraged his fans to take his music, remix it, and he would post it up on his website, which is something that could only be done through a Creative Commons license.
Which actually brings up another issue that I probably should have mentioned earlier. When you're putting out your album to begin with, I was kind of working under the assumption whatever you're doing, you're going to be putting out your own content. But say you want to cover music. A lot of people like to cover music. There's a lot of benefit to doing it. But unless there's a Creative Commons license giving you the right to do that, you're committing copyright infringement, and if you ever get big, you're going to get sued. It's really more a matter of how much money is it. Nobody's going to bother suing you as long as you're small time, but if you ever make it big, you could be walking yourself into trouble because you've been infringing copyrights for years. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that was my question about MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you that's what they made. But, you know, Bach, Beethoven, stuff like that, I didn't really see it. We had a non-music MySpace page, and I took it down. Is there any reason for us?
Well, Bach and Beethoven are not really in a position to sue you at this time.
Well, but nothing.
So you cover more recent, you do...
We have done some recent stuff. It's just a graph.
Well, basically, the deal is like Bach and Beethoven are in the public domain. In the United States, if you copyright something, it's good for 75 years after the person dies. So Bach and Beethoven clearly have been dead for longer than 75 years.
So what's more recent stuff that you've done? But
not
this is
personally,
but you're talking about
anything real recent, and even people that are not that are no longer in a position to come sue you, their estate might be. As an example, the Elvis estate is notorious for suing people for ripping off his stuff. He's been dead for years. So if you're going to do covers, you need to go get what's called a mechanical license. And it's their standard in the music industry. Any song that's been publicly released, they're required by federal copyright law to issue that mechanical license. You just have to go do it. Most publishers and most your majors, they use the Harry Fox Agency as a clearinghouse, and all you have to do is get a license from Harry Fox. Now, that requires money, but it's better than the alternative.
Are you selling CDs? Are you, or is this just you're putting it on MySpace just for people to enjoy? And that.
Yeah, we have a Facebook and a Twitter, and we just wanted to get it out. We have an ASCAP license, but the board
that covers live performances.
Right.
Yeah,
no.
The board wasn't sure about. Like we have some snippets of our concerts on YouTube. We weren't sure if we were in trouble or.
The worst that can happen, the good news is that for the most part, if you're just under the radar and you're not really commercially benefiting from this, the worst that happens is YouTube will pull the video. This actually happened with Suffocation. Someone put up a fan video of Suffocation's song. It was this guy, very straight laced. Suit and tie guy. He set up a drum kit in his office and he drummed along to one of Suffocation's song. That song was on an album put up by Roadrunner, which is owned by Warner Brothers.
Ooh.
So Warner has these like interns and automatic things basically searching YouTube that looking for copyrighted music. And we loved it. The band talked to the guy and says, it's awesome. He actually did a really good job. And funnily enough, that video generated more hits than official Suffocation videos. So we were like, we were sure that we probably gained new fans because of this video. Warner pulled it. And that had two negative effects. One, we lost all that free publicity. Two, the guy who put the video up posted on a blog about, hey, what happened? And they basically started bad-mouthing the label. Luckily, none of that negative backlash hit the band. And no one said, oh, bunch of idiots, but they said, oh, the label sucks, and I can't believe they did this. And we actually had to fight to get the video put back up. So, and that's an automated thing. It wasn't like someone at Warner Brothers made a conscious decision. It was Warner copyrighted music, and it was automatically pulled from YouTube. And that's where, if it was under a Creative Commons license, they could still sell the music, but we would not have been pulled like that.
Well, and that's another issue with signing with one of the majors, too. I know a lot of people, they push, they want to get signed. Once you get signed, you don't own your music anymore. They're going to take it. That's what they do. So you end up with issues like that where you and the record label have a disagreement over what your music should be, what you should do with it. But they own it now, so they win. And ultimately, I mean, unless you can just find other means of coercing them, you're going to kind of have to do what they say.
Mm-hmm.
But
where the benefit is, and can I tell?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Story? I love this story. I've used this so many times. How many people here are familiar with Jonathan Coulton's music? Code Monkey, Re Your Brands, hysterical, hysterical stuff. For the people who aren't. For those who aren't familiar with him, he is a musician from Brooklyn who is a computer programmer. And he wrote songs about computer programming and about zombies and about alien invasions. It's basically filk, but it was good. And it was very catchy, very listenable, and definitely commercially viable despite the topics it was about. And he releases music under the Creative Commons license. He sold his songs through iTunes, but you could listen to it for free if you wanted, and he allowed people to take his music and do things with them for non-commercial purposes. So as long as you weren't going to turn around and sell it yourself, he didn't care. He said, do whatever you want. So an animation company using World of Warcraft machinima techniques put out a whole slew of music videos and put them up on YouTube using Jonathan Coulton's music. And the two, I think the most popular ones is Code Monkey, because they eventually got used for a theme song for a web animation thing called Code Monkey, and Re Your Brains got about 4 million views and about 2.5 million views respectively. All those things, part of the Creative Commons license is attribution. Hmm. You must say where the music comes from. So on all of these YouTube videos in the little discussion thing, this is Jonathan Coulton. Here's his website. You can buy his music through iTunes through his website. He sold so many songs through iTunes, he quit his job and did music full time. And I hear he commands about $3,000 to $5,000 per live performance. So here's someone who, allowing his music to be used for free, benefited financially in the long run because of it, by letting people use his music in clever and creative ways. Well, yeah.
Right. And that's...
That really helps. You'd be amazed how much that helps, that having your stuff be that people want to listen to.
Yeah, people, there's always... I have friends, lots of friends of bands, and they all think they're going to be like, come out of nowhere and they'll be like the Beatles. It's like, do you have any idea how many years they played all kinds of crappy clubs before they ever became famous and got out in front of people?
Absolutely. And even independent artists don't all agree. I mean, most of the time, most independent artists are going to have the same argument, like, hey, any publicity is free publicity, it's good, and if people want to download our music, we don't care. Not every independent artist has that opinion. Of someone who plays the Voltaire plays here all the time, he hates it when people download his music. He goes, if I want to give my music away for free, then I will do so. It should be the artist's decision. It should be their decision whether they want their music done for free. Even if it's a good or bad business move, maybe he might make more money, but it's his music. He wrote it, he performed it, he spent money to put it out, and he should be the one to decide whether or not it's free or not. So not everyone agrees, even independent, not everyone is Metallica, and not everyone is just, hey, take my music, I don't care.
Well, another thing too, as far as, you know, it helps if your music is good, but good is a very relative term. And even if your music is not necessarily mainstream, there still is a potential for a niche market there if that niche market thinks your music is good. So part of it is trying to find and target the people who like what you do, not necessarily change your style to be more mainstream, although that may be a better business decision in the long run.
Well, niche marketing, the good and bad of niche marketing is it is easy to find your niche, but you have a ceiling. So if you are, you know, extreme noise industrial or gothabilly or death metal, you know, you have a built-in market that is easy for you to access, but there is a ceiling, and occasionally you will get a band like the Ramones who were more than punk and who broke out, or Metallica, or someone who is in a niche and then who goes beyond that niche. But for the most part, that is the benefit of being a niche. It's easy to find your people. You know, you find other again, like with MySpace, you find other bands and you find the zines and the blogs and the people who will review that, and you can connect with them very, very easily. It's an easily accessible group. But then, you know, you're not going to get, you know, like when Suffocation hit the Billboard Top 200, we were ecstatic because not many death metal bands get to do that.
Well, and I guess kind of wrap this whole thing up, this section up at least, is that you use all these tools to try to cross-promote, cross-link as much as you can, and use them to really promote those concerts that you're still going on as you're doing all this. Another key issue is you really need an artist's website. It's just, if you don't have a website, and this is for any business, if you don't have a website, you don't exist. That's just the way things are going. Getting a professional to do it is key. One of the things I hear a lot is, oh, I got my cousin to do it, or I asked my cousin to do it 6 months ago and nothing has happened yet. And that's one thing you got to worry about with that. It helps to get a professional that can do something good, because this is if you're doing online marketing, your website is what people are seeing, but also that it shows up in a timely manner. A good website, in my opinion, at the very minimum needs to show your concert dates and should link to some place where you can get products. Other options, you can sell your products directly through there. I mean, you can link through to PayPal and that sort of thing. You can use your artist's website as a base for e-blasting, but don't spam. Like we were discussing earlier, every 2 weeks at most, if you put things out there all the time, people will block you, remove you, you'll become annoying, so don't do that. So you use it to sell your merchandise. Being able to have some kind of a radio player up there helps. Photo galleries, anything that a consumer might want to look at to see more about you. Blogs are a possibility if you want to take the time to do it. Interact with your fans. Maybe you want them making comments. Maybe you don't. Now, the downside is if you let your fans make comments, they will make comments, and you're going to have to deal with them whether they're good or bad. The other thing being, keep your site active. A lot of people are bad about put a site up there, go on, move on to other things, look back in a year, your content's real stale. That's something you need to kind of keep on.
Make sure your content is consistent throughout all of your online properties.
Right.
Make sure a new album comes out. If you have a Facebook, MySpace, YouTube, everything's updated. More than once, I'll be investigating a band and their website will be 2 years out of date. If you have a news section, that's the first step is, if you have a news section with the most recent thing and it's dated and the most recent news item is 2 years ago, no one's going to investigate the rest of the site. They're going to think the band's broken up. You know, so keeping it updated so that when people go there, they will find the most recent information and that's consistent between all of your different properties.
Okay, and I've kind of got some examples here, and I pulled my wife's work because she's not going to sue me. So use these as kind of a basis. Here's some examples of some things she's done that use some of this stuff. Like you've got the side in the upper left-hand box there. There's a jukebox where you, and this is a country band, so you'd call it a jukebox, where you click it up, it pops up, plays their music. Notice they've got like a tour section so you can see where what they're doing. You've got their MySpace page link in there, maybe some downloads for wallpapers or whatever you can think of that they might like.
One piece of advice I'm going to continue, never, ever, ever use autoplay. Make someone push a button to hear your music. I hate it going to a website. I mean, if I'm working in an office with eight other people, or some people, believe it or not, will check their stuff at the library or whatever, you do not want to have your site play music the moment someone opens it up. That's the quickest way to get them to just hit the X and just close it.
Well, and also, too, if someone's on a lower speed connection, if it has to start playing your music before the site loads, that's a problem. So they may close it down just waiting for everything to get ready. So, yeah, autoplay is a real bad idea. Another example up here, we've got this site on the upper right-hand side. You can kind of see how you've got your tour dates set out so that your fans can see where you're going to be, when you're going to be there, just so that if you've got people who are actually following you around, they can do that. Like in this one also, they apparently wanted something with mixer tones for some ringtones, so you can kind of link through there. Again, we've got this Jeff Maddox guy down on the bottom left, and here's kind of an about him, so you can see here's what he's doing. Again, some cross-linking with MySpace. And then the site on the bottom right, there's actually some video content, so if you want to see, she had a music video done, if you want to see that music video, you can play it right there, and again, more promotional stuff.
I mean, most of this advice is pretty much that for anyone who makes any kind of website for any reason,
right,
make it easy to navigate, make it easy to find out the information that they're looking for. If someone comes to a band website, they probably are looking for a particular piece of information. Either they've already heard the band, they know what it sounds like, they just want to see where they're playing, or someone said, you got to check this band out. So you make it very easy to find the information that anyone could be looking for. It sounds ridiculous to have to give that advice, but again, I go to these band websites and I can't even navigate it. And they're so, like MySpace pages, where they're so focused on the design and all the stupid pictures and everything like that, where I can't find the buttons. Make the buttons visible. I mean, like very simple. I mean, I don't want to take too much time on this, but just
right,
like all the advice for making any kind of website applies to band websites.
Well, and it doesn't hurt, again, to get a professional web designer to do this kind of stuff because they do these things all the time. They don't even have to think about this stuff. They just know it. And shameless plug here. This is my wife's website. She does band stuff, howldesign.com. She's back in the back if you want to talk to her. Okay, and royalties. Here's something else that you as you go forward, as you find success in this career, these are little pockets of money that you may not know exist that you need to sign up for. It's a really good thing. Sound Exchange. These guys, they do artist royalties for webcasting, digital cable, satellite radio, TV, whatever. If your music gets picked up and starts getting played on internet radio, you get royalties from them. Very good thing. BMI, ASCAP, CSAC. These guys do writer and publisher royalties. If you're writing your music, and I make that distinction because artist royalties applies to anyone who is playing a song. Writer and publisher applies to people who wrote a song and own it. So there can be a distinction and often is in more complex situations. If you're doing songwriting, you want to be signed up with either BMI, ASCAP, or CSAC at a minimum. You really want to be signed up as a publisher on both because anytime there's any kind of royalty situation, royalties get chopped in half. You've got a publisher half and a writer half. And BMI, ASCAP, and CSAC, they will capture that writer half and give it to you if you're a writer, but if you don't have a publishing company signed up with them, they don't capture that income. So it just kind of goes away.
I think an important, to really show the importance of the modern licensing, is the publishing of music is probably even more important now because there's a lot more opportunities for the licensing of music, for commercials, for web-based TV programs. So there's a lot more opportunities. And does everyone know what a publisher does? Anyone not know what a publisher does? Oh, okay, good. Sometimes you'd be surprised how many musicians are like, what is a publisher? So what a good publisher will start to do is actually get your music used for things, for TV and movies, for commercials. But the licensing of music for different properties, it's an alternate revenue stream. And it's a way for, there are people like Cell Dweller, perfect example. Most people don't know who he is. I guarantee you've heard his music. He's been in Spider-Man soundtrack. All he does is soundtracks. That's it. He sells some CDs, but basically he does soundtracks. Graham Revell does a soundtrack for like everything. He used to be an industrial band. Now he just does soundtracks. So you don't have to follow the traditional band model, especially if you're an electronic musician and not so much a rock band. If you're a hip-hop artist, there are other things you can do with your music besides just sell CDs or sell your music directly to the fans. You can get it used in different things, and that could be a great avenue for revenue. And again, that's something that SonicBits has opportunities for. This is something I'm actually designing a website to help the networking aspects of it. So if you can find opportunities for people to use your music, even if it doesn't pay up front, like with the Jonathan Colton thing, it could pay down the line. If you start developing a reputation for making music, you know, like if you're a composer, a songwriter, or an electronic musician that people want to use for their ads or for their TV or their web stuff, it could turn into a source of revenue down the line.
Well, and another thing, a little caveat to that, though, just like in the rest of this discussion, there are disreputable people, there are disreputable publishers, and the worst thing you can do is sign over your music rights to a publisher and have them sit on them, because you can only do that once. You don't have them anymore. So if you sign over that publisher and they don't do anything with it, you're stuck. And that song is pretty much dead because nobody's going to touch it now because you don't have anything left to give them. So one thing that can help in some deals like that is to have some kind of right of reversion so that if the publisher doesn't do anything with it, it pops back to you in a year or two. But the main thing being is when you're looking for a publisher, if you're not going to just do self-publishing and just handle it yourself, make sure that they actually have a good track record and they are professionals and not just some guy. Any questions?
Before we open up, one of the things when I was first asked to do this panel was to, in this day and age, what is the place of the record labels? And I still think, for the time being, record labels have their place. And if you were offered a legitimate deal from a legitimate record label, of course consider it, because they can still get your music played on the radio, they can still get your videos on whatever video channels are still playing music videos, and they can still set you up with tours and with other bands. So even with the internet, record labels are not dead. they're coughing up blood, they're hurting, they're not signing nearly as many bands as they used to, they demand more immediate gratification and benefit from their artists, but they still perform an important service for the music industry. So don't completely discount it, but for the most part, it probably is not, no offense to any musicians here, but it's probably not going to be an issue, but I just wanted to at least say that.
Well, and the other thing, the main thing with a record label is that they have connections and they have experience that you don't necessarily have. So, again, they're worth considering if the deal is good, but is what it is.
So, any last minute questions? Yeah. I think we're being asked to wrap it up.
There's so many... There's so many musicians out there trying to sell their music, and you hear all this stuff, oh, it's endless possibilities. How do you actually get any advice for actually getting new people to hear your music besides just the fans from shows and friends of friends and things like that? I mean, even if you're distinguished, I mean, there's so much to choose from. How do you separate yourself from that? I mean, it's hard to get somebody to actually click play sometimes.
Yeah, I think that question right there is how the music industry of the 21st century is going to reinvent itself. I think, how do we discover new music? Most things like CD Baby, Pandora, have a recommend feature, meaning if I like the Ramones or I like Depeche Mode, recommend me bands that I might like. The problem is most of that is being done by the artists themselves. Oh yeah, we sound like Depeche Mode, or we sound like Metallica, and they freaking well don't. There's no objective service out there acting, as what I was saying before, a tastemaker. Of really, you just have to find blogs that do CD reviews or music reviews that you trust. If you're into a particular genre of music, there's a lot of live365.com and other internet radio that will, like, I like synth pop, or I like punk, or I like country music, and they will play independent as well as mainstream artists of that music. But I think that's going to be the, if record labels want to stay relevant and current, they're going to have to answer that exact question.
And really the best we can say at this point is, use your MySpace, your Facebook, your YouTube, your free tools, and, you know, try to do your gig gates, and that's really about the best you can guarantee. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. It's just going to take a lot of hard work and some luck, and hopefully...
The internet's not taking away live music.
No.
That's the good thing. Clubs are still there. Playing out live is still there. You know, the CDs and everything, that might be changing, but live music is still live music. So, now... What if you're a type of artist that live music is not that conducive to, like hip-hop or electronic? Club DJs are still out there. So there's DJ services that you can get hooked into. So it's still getting your music out on the street level to the people who are open to finding out about new music. But I would, trust me, if I had the objective answer to that, I would...
We have time for one more, or we need to wrap it up?
Okay. Thank you very much.